If you've been here the last few Wednesday nights, we've been talking about John 17. Now, you may remember that in John 17, you have what is the longest prayer in the New Testament. Jesus was the one who offered that prayer. As the Lord began that prayer in John chapter 17, he talks about himself. Then he turns to the apostles. Then he turns to the people who are going to believe on the apostles. And then you have some basic information about the world. We finished up that prayer last week. So tonight what we want to do is see what happens immediately after that prayer. That comes from John chapter 18, verse 1. Then after John 18, verse 1, things get a little more complicated. You start heading towards Jesus in the garden. Jesus is arrested. And then you have the crucifixion. John has some information that you don't have in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have some information that John doesn't have. So in trying to figure out how to best teach this class, and there is some difficulty as far as trying to get everything to line up so it flows in a good way, you either have to have some people who are flipping to the passages back and forth. That's not always the smoothest thing. Or you have to have some people who are ready to read some passages, and if you want to follow along, that can be difficult. Or you have to provide some kind of handout. So we're going to try the handout version. Again, everybody should have a copy of something that looks like this. It has Matthew 26, 36 to 39, Mark 14, 32 to 38, and Luke chapter 22, verses 39 to 45 at the top of it. Anybody lacking this material? We are going to be referring to that at various times, but as I said, let's start with John chapter 18, verse 1, because this is what takes place after Jesus finishes that prayer. It says, when. Well, that word when takes us back to the time after the Lord had finished the prayer. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook of Kidron. There was a garden, which he entered himself and his disciples. The words, what do you think that refers to? Jesus had spoken, he'd finished up these words. What do you think that goes back to?
His prayer.
Well, okay, John 17. And you could actually step that back a few more chapters, John 16, and John 15, and John 14, and John 13. We've tried to, I know it's taken a while for all that to get connected, but remember back there in John chapter 13, what act did Jesus do that some still not want to do as a religious act? He washed the feet. And today there's some people who say, well, let's wash feet. No, that's not what he had in mind there. It was a need for humility. You be humble, John 13, because not very long I'm going to die, and what am I going to establish? I'm going to establish my church, John chapter 14. You have humility in the church. And then in John chapter 15, he said, I am the vine and you are the branches. Another way to describe that church where they needed to be humble. And to get knowledge about that church, John chapter 16, Jesus said, the Holy Spirit's going to come, and what's he going to do? He's going to guide you into all truth. So out there in the church, you're going to know what needs to be done. And then in John chapter 17, what was that prayer for? Jesus said, my prayer is that you are going to be one, even as the Father is one with me. So the church needs to be unified. So John 13, John 14, John 15, John 16, John 17, several chapters. A lot of great material, but it is all closely connected, and it's connected to the time period just before Jesus goes to the cross. So when Jesus had spoken those words, John 13 through John 17, he goes forth with the apostles, with the disciples, over the brook of Kidron, and there, of course, was a garden there. Okay, a couple quick points. Kidron, if you maybe have notes in your Bible that may be identified as a word which means gloomy or dark. And almost every reference that you find in the Bible to Kidron is an unpleasant reference. I'm going to give you this quote because it sums it up better than I probably could in some way. Quote, The gloomiest night in the Kidron was the night Jesus was betrayed. Above the Kidron Valley sat the temple. At Passover, more than 250,000 lambs were slain for the sacrifices of the people. The blood flowed, now just try to get this in your head, the blood flowed from the temple down the side of the hill to the Kidron Valley, staining the hillside black. It must have been a horrendous sight. When Jesus made his way from the upper room to a garden on his final Passover, the blood was already rushing into the Kidron. As the Lord crossed the brook, he saw the Kidron running red with the fresh blood of abundant sacrifices. Now that's an assumption, that's not in the text, but that seems to be a reasonable conclusion. What a powerful reminder that his blood soon would be poured out in a similar sacrifice for us all. Now, I like that because I do think that is very likely, that as Jesus is making this trip, you do have the sacrifices being slaughtered, the blood is coming down, and that was very likely, or at least possibly, visible to the Lord and his disciples. Anything that you want to add or ask before I make a couple quick points? Brent?
Some pointed to 1 Kings 2 was a type year, in that chapter, verses 36 and 37, King Solomon had told Shimei, as long as you stay in Jerusalem, I won't hurt you, you can live. But be sure that the day you cross the Kidron, you're going to die. And some has pointed to that as a sort of foreshadowing of what's happened to Jesus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's possible as well, but you do have that idea of gloominess, death, destruction, and that would be one more great reference to introduce. Thank you very much. Anybody else before I make a couple of extra points? All right. Where's Jesus headed? He went forth with his disciples over the brook of Kidron where there was a garden. He's headed to a garden. Does that strike you as a little odd? Interesting. Think about the beginning. Genesis chapter 2 verse 8. Where was man put? Man's put in a garden. And as you continue to look in the Bible, where do Adam and Eve sin? They're in the garden. Now they had to sin in the garden because that's where you get that forbidden fruit from. That was located in the garden, Genesis 3, 2 through 3, and Genesis chapter 6. Now it doesn't specifically say that they were hiding in the garden. I think that's kind of implied. But Genesis 3 verse 8, they hid from God. And then Genesis 3 verse 28, what was true when it came to access to the garden? All right, they lost it. The garden was sealed off. They couldn't get back to the tree of life. So Jesus comes. He's now in another garden. He's preparing to die. John talked about this a couple of times in Revelation 2 verse 7. He talked about the paradise of God, which sounds like a garden, and also in describing the church, Revelation 22 verse 2, uses similar imagery there to describe what we would expect to find in a garden. And then too, this isn't really in view in John 18, but you do find it in the next chapter, John 19, verse 41. Jesus' tomb was located where? It was a garden tomb. So it's kind of interesting that you see Adam messes things up in a garden, but where does Jesus begin to fix things? In a garden. Begins to have the prayer. He's buried in a garden and so forth. Rises from the garden. So is that coincidental or not? I am inclined to think it's probably not it's just a chance category. But again, God hasn't been more specific than what we've outlined thus far. Anything that you want to add or ask before we, Gary?
Is this a garden like we would think of a garden today?
I'm just going to stop you. We are going to talk about that, but let's not get quite that far yet. But we're headed there. Something else?
Maybe kind of, tell me if it's going to be later too, but a lot of times when God lines things up like that compared to Old Testament, New Testament, obviously there's a spiritual meaning. A lot of times there's a practical meaning too for the human side of Jesus. Is there any, so it was normal for them to go relax in a garden if they were dealing with something?
Let's just set that aside for a couple minutes. And if I don't fully address it, we'll come back to it. I promise. Okay? Anybody else? All right, if you have your sheet, and I'm going to be, for the hopefully duration of the class and to make this a little easier, I'm just going to be calling out some verses here. Maybe I'll ask you to read it from a sheet, but at least you can look across the sheet or open up your own Bible to these places and read it from your own translation. But I'm going to be turning over to Matthew 26, verse 36, and continuing, for the most part, with Matthew 26. This is going to be the main chapter that I draw from. But as needed, we will be inserting some additional references, especially for Mark, and a few from Luke as we go along. All right, now we have, remember back there in John 18, verse 1, it was when they'd finished up all that stuff, John 13 through 17, now it's then. So, when they came to the garden, now, then, cometh Jesus with them unto a place called Gethsemane, and saith unto his disciples, sit ye here, while I go yonder and pray. But once again, that word then kind of takes us back, it points us back to the period that we've been discussing, especially John 13 through John 18, verse 1. All right, Jesus had finished that prayer, and now he wants the disciples to sit while he goes yonder to pray. And you have a fuller statement of this in Luke chapter 22, verses 40 and 41. If you were to look across your sheet, and when he was at the place, he said unto them, pray that ye enter not into temptation. He was parted from them about a stone's cast. He kneeled down and prayed. If you didn't look at Luke's account, you wouldn't know how far he went. So it wasn't very far that he headed off by himself. The disciples were still in that immediate area, but Jesus did go a little ways by himself. All right, where did the Lord take the disciples? He took them to a place called Gethsemane. Anybody know what Gethsemane meant? Gethsemane, anybody know what it meant? Olive press, or oil press would be the meaning for it. And as you think about that, for us, maybe somebody can come up with a good illustration of this, but you want to squeeze out, well, maybe some of the ladies on a juicer, if you want to squeeze out every drop of your lemon or of your orange or your grapefruit, how do you do it? All right, you're going to have to use either a lot of pressure by hand or you're going to have to find some kind of machine which can really work that. How do you think they, in ancient times, first century times, how do you think they got the juice out of those olives?
Stone.
All right, large stones. Very, very large stones. And there's some people, and this begins to go back to the question that you raised, Gary. A lot of people, and I was of this persuasion for a long time, there are a lot of folks who believe that there was an actual Garden of Gethsemane, just as we would talk about the Rose Garden, or we would say that this is going to be the Botanical Gardens in a certain city and so forth. A lot of people, I think, and maybe most people, have that particular idea. I don't think, though, that's quite correct. When you look at that word Gethsemane, it's coming from two different Hebrew words that meant the place where olive oil is pressed. Now think about that just for a second. Gethsemane. The place where olive oil is pressed. If that's the right definition for it, what does that tell you as far as there being a specific Gethsemane? Did everybody go to the same? Be like an apple orchard. Is there only one apple orchard in our state? No. There are bunches of places where you can go and you can have your cider made from apples. So you say the orchard. Well, we would say which one? There might be four or five in our immediate area. And a similar thing was true for the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, as you look at Matthew 26:36, the verse that we read, let's take a look at that once more. Then he comes unto them a place called Gethsemane, a place called the wine press. There are some people, and if you remember the videos that we showed this year, there was a couple of clips where the fellow actually said, I'm going to show you a Gethsemane. Anybody remember that? Okay, if you saw it, and if you can kind of go back in time and remember that part of the video that we showed, that's, you know, it would be like, as I said, going to the apple orchard. And this is the apple orchard. And how they do things here is going to be very similar to how they do things over here, but it may be a little different. If you needed that kind of place, one option might be to set it up in a cave. We don't know for sure, but that may have been where the Lord and the disciples went. They went to this Gethsemane that was in a cave. And before he goes to sleep, Jesus has been talking to the apostles. The day's been long. And as you look at Matthew 26, verse 37, that next verse, and he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and sore troubled. As you look back to John 18, verse 1, that's where we started tonight. But you back down a few verses and you come to verse 26. One of the servants of the high priest, being a kinsman of him whose ear Peter had cut off, said, Did not I see thee where? In the garden with him. That is, in this place that was known as Gethsemane. So we don't know exactly where that was. Could have been in a cave, but it was an area where olives were pressed. Now, a couple of quick points there. What was going on at the time that we've been talking about? Remember the Kidron Valley, the blood coming down the hill? What was the cause of that? All right, it was time for the Passover. All right, if it's Passover time, what's going to be happening as far as visitors in town? You're going to have a lot of people from out of town. Same thing happens today. Convention comes to town, or three or four conventions come to town. And even if you have a large city, Philadelphia, Boston, San Diego, what happens? Conventioners come into town. All the rooms are taken, right? How many people are with Jesus now, at least? Well, we've got Judas out of the picture, right? Remember John 13, 14, 15, 16, 17? He's departed. So we've got the Lord plus how many apostles? 11. If you've got 12 guys that you need to find a spot for, that's not the easiest thing in the world. Sometimes getting, you know, one or two situated, or a family that has a couple kids, that can be very, very difficult. So you have what we believe to be at least 12 people, and they needed to find some kind of lodging for the night because this was Passover time. Now, Gary, this goes back to the point that you were making just a little while ago. As far as God providing for his people, I think that we have an example of that here. Passover time, there needs to be a place to go. Where's a logical place? You've got a Gethsemane. You've got a place where people are going to be pressing out olives when that time of year is there. Would that have likely given you some privacy, or you think that's going to be down there on the main street? You're going to have some privacy. Jesus is facing the cross, wants some surely private time with the apostles. This was surely an ideal time. Now, it may have been sort of a camping trip. They were not going to be made very comfortable in somebody's house and get all the goodies that you might normally associate with that, but this was ideal. If you think about just prior to this time, hadn't God provided for the Lord? What did Jesus need to come riding into Jerusalem? He needed that donkey, and was one provided? Yep, donkey just happens to be there at the right time. And then, wasn't there another provision? What was the feast? Passover. And what happened with Passover? You had to get the... All right, you had to get the elements. You had to get the lamb and the various spices and everything, and you've got to have a place to eat. Well, if you're going to do that with 12 guys, or 13 if you include Judas, and he was there for a time, you're going to do that with at least 13 people. That's going to require some space. And, you know, you're going to need some space to prepare all those kinds of things. So when you start looking at what God did, yes, there was a need, God provided. Passover, donkey, it just continues to line up time after time after time. And in many respects, it looks like it came maybe not exactly in the nick of time, but I mean, it was, the need is here. Here's how we're going to meet it. Did you have another thought on that? Okay. Brian?
It seems like though this particular spot was frequented by Jesus.
Yes.
Because John 18:2, Judas knew the place because Jesus often went there.
Yes. You'll also have, we'll probably mention this again, but in Luke chapter 22, verse 39, notice this. He came out and went as his custom was. So you're absolutely correct that this was a habit, this was something that the disciples were very, very familiar with. Now, again, this might be coincidence, but you have to look at it and wonder just a little bit. Thinking about what a Gethsemane was, what did we say it was? We defined it as a place where you go and you crush the olives with the big stones. What was about to happen to Jesus? Well, all right, he'd already been betrayed. That was sort of crushing.
Well, they were going to be coming to get him.
All right, so you have the mob that's going to be showing up soon. And after the mob, what begins to take place? He's beaten, he's reviled, and then ultimately, where does he go? The cross. Can you imagine what it felt like to go through all those things? The crushing weight. So I don't know that that was necessarily why he ended up with the disciples in Gethsemane, but it certainly is picturesque if you can kind of put your mind around those details. Remember from Luke chapter 22, verse 44, that is also on the sheet. Jesus, as you look at Luke's account, what's he say in Luke? His sweat became as great drops of blood falling on the ground. I don't know if you've ever thought about it in these terms, but here is a person who's sweating. It's almost like they're being squeezed. You have, and we'll talk about later what that may have been or maybe what that wasn't. But you've got these great drops as if it were blood coming out of the body. That sounds a little bit like you're taking some olives and doing what with them? You're just crushing them and squeezing them. So when you start looking at this place where they crushed olives, Gethsemane, there are multiple things that you can associate with it that seem to tie in very, very well with the life of Jesus. Anything that you want to add or ask before I make a couple more points? Okay. I've never been to Israel. Maybe one day that will happen for me. I don't know. But as I read about some people who have gone there, it's just like today. If you get the tour guide and he says, well, it was like this back in 1776. You ever wonder a little bit whether or not it really was? I do. I mean, how's he know what was happening 200 and, 40 or 250 years ago. But, I mean, they will give you the tour, and they will say, this is the way it was. Abraham Lincoln sat right here in this chair and drank his cup of coffee. I mean, that's a coffee ring. Well, you know, I don't know that I'm necessarily going to buy that, but that's sometimes how people talk. And if you go to that area today, you will have, at least this is the way that has been done, some people who will say, this is the Garden of Gethsemane. Well, that's interesting, because Titus, remember who he was? That fellow about 40 years later, he came to Jerusalem, led the attack, Jerusalem was razed, he cut down all the trees. So when they come along and say, well, these are the olive trees, this is the grove where Jesus was. Well, that could be true, but maybe that is certainly not the place. So we do know that Jesus was in the custom of going to this area, as Brian mentioned, also what we have in Luke chapter 22 verse 40, and then John's account, John 18 verse 2, I think is a passage Brian was referencing. Jesus oft times resorted thither to this place with his disciples. Anybody want to discuss anything before we look at Matthew 26, 37 to 39, the first part of 39? Okay. Let's continue reading. Let's pick up 37 from Matthew 26. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and sore troubled. Then saith he unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful even unto death. Abide ye here and watch with me. And I'm going to read all 39, but we'll just deal with the first part of it. And he went forward a little and fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass away from me. Nevertheless, not as I wilt, but as thou wilt. All right, we have Peter plus the two sons of Zebedee. Anybody remember who the two sons of Zebedee were? James and John, Mark chapter 14, verse 33. And they were part of the Lord's... All right, the Lord's intimate friends, they were part of that inner circle. They had been with Jesus when the transfiguration took place, Matthew 17, verses 1 and 2. They had been with Jesus when a young lady was healed, back there in Luke chapter 8, verse 51. And Jesus asked these fellows to come with him. Now, if you're looking at that text on your own, one of the questions that you might ask is why? Why did they come with him? And there are some, I think, good reasons why Jesus may have asked these guys to come. I'll give you one, and then maybe you can come up with some others. The text says he began to be what? All right. If you're going through a difficult time, what might you want? All right. Somebody to talk to, somebody to offer some comfort and consolation. Now, you may want to be alone, but sometimes people, they say sometimes misery loves company. So maybe it would be that we would want someone with us. Any other reasons that you can think of why Jesus might have had these three guys come along? Remember, they're about a stone's throw away. So they're back a little bit, but they're in the general area. Right?
I believe it was there at the transfiguration that we read the first part of the Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Some have suggested, and this is kind of an interesting thought, that you begin to see Jesus sharing in his glory. Here they're going to share some information about his death, the victory over death back there in Luke chapter 8. So because they had shared in those previous two things, maybe it was logical and right for them to share in this. Some other ideas that also might be right. Peter, just prior to this time, had said he was going to be faithful even unto death. And James and John, remember, they were the fellows who said to Jesus, we can drink what? We can drink the same cup that you can. So I find it interesting that they're the two that make that statement. And now these are two of the three who are also going with Jesus to be with him as he offers this particular prayer. And it may be, in view of that, that Jesus might have been thinking, hey, you three need extra prayer. Peter, you need some prayer because you said, I'm going to stick with you. All the other guys will forsake you. I'm going to stay with you. And Jesus had to correct him a little bit. And the other two fellas, they also were not headed in the right direction as far as thinking, oh, we can do that too. And yes, we are willing to drink the cup that you're willing to, or you're going to drink. So it may be that he was going to be mindful of them, or they needed to learn from this as well. Let's look at some of the specific words. In Matthew 26, 37, the word that's translated sorrowful, it may be something different in the translation that you have, but you should see that word on the sheet. It denotes not just sorrow, but it denotes deep sorrow. What would you associate deep sorrow with? Deep sorrow. Deep sorrow. What comes to mind? All right. I think when you think about a personal loss as far as a death, that might be a good example. What else? Deep sorrow.
He's suffering.
All right. Suffering. Great suffering. Anything else?
Fear of
All right, he does, and we're going to see that with some of the other words. It's interesting that when you look at that term that's used, remember over in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 30, Paul said, grieve not who in whom you were sealed. Grieve not the Holy Spirit. Same word. He said that we can deeply offend, we can deeply grieve, we can deeply hurt the Holy Spirit. And then this would relate to a couple of the answers. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 13, Paul used this same word to describe death. That passage says, sorrow not as those who have no hope. And that to me really gets us to the crux of the word. You can imagine the people at a funeral who are sorrowing and they have no hope. Maybe they don't believe in a God. Or maybe they are someone who knows that a non-Christian has passed and they say, I believe that that person will be spending eternity somewhere else. And the sorrow, the grief, overcome with great emotion. If this were the only word that were used to describe Jesus' sorrow in the garden, it would be enough. But it's not. Multiple words are used to give us a picture as far as what is taking place. We have the sorrowful in the ASV, and then you have another word which is translated sore troubled. And one source defined that to be in distress. There was also this interesting suggestion. One source suggested that this could describe homesickness. Now that's a word that I have never heard associated with Jesus, and not a word that I typically associate with him. But as he's thinking about, maybe what life or existence had been life and like in heaven and what he was going to have to go through, he is really overwhelmed with emotion. Certainly he didn't see this world as his home, and we shouldn't either. Matthew, as you look at 26, verse 38, we read that passage too. It has a third word that's an adjective which is translated exceeding sorrow. It words describes, and I'll give you the definition here, it describes the pangs of a deep inner conflict that accompanies two opposing desires. And I want to run a couple passages where this same word is used. Let's head somebody over to Mark 6, verse 26. And then the other one is going to be Luke chapter 18, verses 23 and 24. Who wants to take care of Mark 6, 26 in just a minute? All right, Don, thanks. Mark 6, 26. Luke 18, 23 and 24. Who wants that one? All right, Gary, Luke 18, 23 and 24. Now remember, we've already got two words for sorrow and distress and grief. It is just reaching into the innermost part of who he is. Building on top of those two words, let's now look at this third word and see how it's used in Mark 6, 26.
And the king was exceedingly sorry, yet for his oath's sake and for their sakes which sat with him, he would not reject her.
Okay, you have to think about what's going on here. It's Herod. He's made the promise up to half his kingdom. He's been asked to deliver up the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And Herod is kind of caught, as we say, between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, what happens if he doesn't please the girl? How does he look in front of his guests? He looks like a liar, he looks weak, and he's not going to keep his word. So you can't have that. But on the other hand, he looks at John and says, this is a righteous guy, so I better not do what? I better not kill him. So it's, which choice am I going to make? I don't like either alternative. And yet the circumstances are driving me to make one decision or the other. And it is very, very difficult to make a choice. Now, I don't know that I would associate the last statement with Jesus. But you do have to have an understanding, I think, of because this word is used, that Jesus feels tension. On the one hand, I have a desire to avoid the cup. But on the other hand, there is this desire to do the Father's will. So when you partake of the Lord's Supper on Sunday, that's one of the things that you might think about. Jesus died for me. He was there on the cross, and all of it was that pressing weight of Gethsemane that was on him before he actually was crucified. Let's take a look at where this word is used again. Luke chapter 18, 23 and 24.
And when he heard this, he was very sorrowful, for he was very rich. And when Jesus saw that he was very sorrowful, he said, how hardly shall they that have riches enter in the kingdom of God?
Okay, this is the ruler who comes to Jesus, wants eternal life. How badly do you think he wanted eternal life? He really wanted it. And yet Jesus said, this is what you need to do. And he's looking at both things. On the one hand, he wants to hold on to his money and possessions. On the other hand, he really wants to love God, serve God, and go to heaven. And he's caught in the middle. And he's struggling, he's weighing both of those choices. Finally, just like Herod, he makes a decision. but he feels like he's under great pressure. And that's exactly the word that is used to describe Jesus in Matthew 26, verse 38. Now, anything that you want to add or ask about that before we add a little bit more? Now, there's another word. And this word is used in Mark 14, verse 33. If you have your sheet, let's see if we can identify it. What word sticks out there? No, that would be a good guess. It's going to be the other one. Yeah. Now, isn't that a strange word? I mean, he's got this grief and he's going through this struggle. And Mark comes along and says, and he taketh with him Peter, James, and John, and he began to be greatly amazed. Well, that sounds like he was, you know, being entertained or something, but that is not the right idea. That is a very strong word. I want to show you where else it's used, and then we'll talk about the significance of it. Let's head over to the book of Mark for a second. It's used in Mark chapter 16, verses 5 and 6. After we look at this verse, or these two verses, and say a little bit more about the word, we'll come back to it again in a couple minutes. But let's go ahead and at least get introduced to it. Mark 16, 5 and 6. Who's got it and is ready to read? All right, Brian?
And entering into the sepulchre, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment. And they were affrighted. And he said unto them, be not affrighted. You see Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him.
Oh, okay. You head to the tomb. You expect it to be shut up. It's open. And you see this angelic creature. What do you think your response is going to be? Oh, that's neat.
Fear.
Terrified. And as you look at this particular word, and you, as I said, you begin to see sort of the connotations associated with Mark 16, verses 5 and 6, it is a terrified surprise. It is a sudden alarm. Another source defined it as an emotional shock. More definitions would be consternation, shuddering horror. So add that to all the things that we've said thus far. Jesus, as he is undergoing this great sorrow, and there is this conflict in his head, he's now, as you look at this additional word, there is what I might say is the sudden realization. It's here. The time has come. This is real. The cross is just hours away. I'm going to die. And I'm going to face the full wrath when it comes to the penalty for sin. So we talked about God's love for man last week and how God loves man just as much as he loves the Son and so forth. And this really is an amazing word. Then Mark also, he doesn't stop here. As you look, and this is I think what Betty pointed out just a moment ago, Mark also, 14:33, uses another word. And that word has sometimes been defined as deeply depressed. One quote says, the exceeding sorrowful soul unto death. You also have that in Mark 14, verse 34, indicates that in his inner being, His emotions, that's plural, his emotions, mind, and feelings were indescribable as far as their grief and distress. He felt that such sorrow in itself could crush the life out of him. I don't know how the Bible could be much plainer when it comes to describing what Jesus is feeling just at this particular time. We talk about the suffering on the cross, but it seems to me that the suffering of Christ began long before the cross. I mean, you have someone who is about as overwhelmed as anybody can be, and then you still have to get through the verbal abuse, the beatings, and finally the crucifixion. So it really is amazing, and I think that helps understand why Jesus said, I want you to come and watch with me. Very likely also concerned about the apostles. The other eight apostles, Judas, of course, had already left the group or some distance away, but Jesus said, I want you to come and I want you to watch with me. And that word watch is also significant. Definitions for it would be abstaining from sleep. I want you to be vigilant, guard against danger, stands in contrast to slothfulness or spiritual lethargy. Anything you want to add or ask before I kind of switch gears for a minute? Brad?
Do you think there could be anything to them maybe providing a witness of what happened here? Because without them being with them, that might... But they fall asleep, so what could they say about it? But at least they were there and could say...
Let's take a look at the book of Hebrews. I think chapter, is it 5? Yeah. Hebrews 5. We don't know who the author is. But in Hebrews 5, starting with verse 7, who in the days of his flesh, that is Jesus, was on the earth, having offered up prayers and supplication, that's what we're reading about now, with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save from death, and having been heard for his godly fear. Though he was a son, then you get into the obedience of Hebrews chapter 5, verses 8 and 9 and so forth. So yes, if I were to try to come up with a quick cross-reference for the point that you just made, that specifically is mentioned elsewhere in the New Testament. And who knows who wrote that particular book. But yes, they were witnesses to that. And this isn't something that somebody just made up and thought, well, yeah, let's stick that in there. So I think that's a great thought.
It's also told what was true, that they would suffer like he did. So they might as well come and see how suffering was.
I think that's a great point, too, that you could sort of add there as a subpoint when it comes to witnesses. Not only has this happened, but guys, you're going to have to man up, because at least some of this will be what you're going to experience as you go out. You know, again, John 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. You need to be humble. The church is going to be created. You're going to be in me. The Spirit's going to come. And you need to make sure you're united as you go through these sufferings. So it really is a very beautiful sequence of chapters. It's probably shouldn't even be divided up into chapters, but you're right. Great thought. Anybody else? Okay, let's take this in a slightly different direction for just a minute. When you begin to look at Jesus suffering, all the things that we've talked about, you also find, and this is not surprising, you find increasing fervency and urgency when it comes to his prayer. In Mark chapter 14, verse 33, going back to that for just one more minute, one source in defining that word, I probably put this in the wrong spot, but it said to make one's hair stand up on end and their flesh to creep. Make your hair stand up on end and your flesh to creep. That's the kind of wording that's used to describe what was taking place. Mark adds, and to be heavy, which denotes that there was an utter sinking of spirit. His heart was melted like wax at what was taking place, the terrible cup. Luke used the strongest terms of all, and he being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. Luke chapter 22, verse 44. And that, again, makes perfect sense in view of what we are saying. The word that is translated combat, or the word that's translated agony in Luke's account, was a word that meant to engage in combat. Jesus, of course, had been in combat with the devil, spiritually speaking, prior to this time. And then, of course, that comes to its climax on the cross. And then here's the point that I was looking for. As Jesus is going through this process, let's see if we can find a progression. Luke chapter 22, verse 41. What do we find as far as Jesus praying? What's said? All right, he kneels. Then let's back up to Mark and see what we got in Mark 14, verse 35. All right, kneels first, falls to the ground, Mark 14, verse 35, and then let's back up to Matthew 26, verse 39. Fall on his face. Ever notice that? As far as the progression of prayer, when it comes to Jesus in the garden, it is 1, 2, 3. You can see the motivation for that based on all the words that we've looked at from Matthew and Mark. Anything that you want to discuss? Okay, 5 minutes left and some really important stuff. So let's see if we can get through that. This is verse 39. And he went forward a little and fell on his face and prayed, saying, My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass away from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. A key word in this verse is cup. Now, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but looking at our handy cheat sheet, let's take a look at Mark's account. Let's take a look at Mark 16 and verse 36. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Remove this what? Remove this cup. But let's back up one verse. And he went forward a little, fell on the ground, and prayed that if it were possible, not the cup, but that the hour might pass from him. Now, I think if that were taught in some places, some people would say, oh, the Bible doesn't say that the hour. He prayed about the hour passing from him. Well, guess what? It does. I think we've heard the cup passing from him so many times that we've sort of come to overlook that detail in Mark chapter 14. Jesus did not identify what this cup, or we might say Mark 14, 35 and 36, what this hour was. But we do know, as you look at the book of John, Jesus said the Father had given him this cup. So that much of it is clear. Most assume that the cup is a metonymy. It stands for his suffering on the cross and the mistreatment that led up to that, and I think that's true. But I also think that a little bit more is going on here. So with about 3 or 4 minutes left, let's see if we can also tie together something else. If you were to look at the book of Revelation, and remember John, who's writing Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, this John, also wrote the book of Revelation. And you find sometimes that John begins to repeat things, talk about the same subjects, but he talks about them with figurative symbols and figurative language in Revelation. All right, in Revelation 14, verse 9, John is talking about the unsaved. And right after 14, verse 9, he says in Revelation 14, 10, the unsaved will drink the wine of the wrath of God, and this wine will be prepared unmixed in the cup, there's that idea again, in the cup of his anger. Now, if you go back and you look at people in ancient times, especially the first century, and you see what they did with wine, they were not generally drinking wine unmixed. They would mix wine. They would dilute it. And it was a pretty serious dilution. So when John says they're going to get the cup of God, and this cup of God is going to be wine that is unmixed, what would that suggest to you? Oh, it's going to be potent. It's going to be strong. There's not going to be any holding back when it comes to the wrath of God. Now, bearing that information in mind, Revelation chapter 14, verses 9 and 10. Drinking the cup, no dilution. When Jesus says, let this cup pass from me, I do think that he's talking about the suffering and so forth, but I also believe that something else is going on here. He says, the cup. With what meaning? What thought may have been there in his mind? The cup is not just suffering, it's going to be how much suffering? Every drop. The cup was going to be unmixed. We sometimes show mercy or grace to someone, give them what they don't deserve, or sometimes we reduce punishment, but it seems to me that Jesus was saying, if I've got to drink this cup, the cup that I have been given is going to be one that I have to drain by myself. No angels are going to show up. Now, could angels have been sent? More than 12 legions, remember? But Jesus said, if I drink the cup, I'm going to have to take it all. There's not going to be any dilution. No angels are going to show up. I'm going to have to face the full wrath of God to pay the price for sin. So that's a very, very interesting thought. Tied in with this, I'll give you one more quick point and see if there's something perhaps that you'd like to ask. A lot of people have suggested that when Jesus prayed, let this cup pass from me, he was praying that there would be some other way than the cross. That's possible. But based on what was said just a moment ago, when he says, let this cup pass from me, how do we define the word cup? How much of God's wrath and punishment was he going to have to take? All. All right, so if he says, let this cup pass from me, it's possible, maybe not probable, but at least it's possible that when he says, let this cup pass, maybe he was thinking, dilute it. I'm willing to suffer, but is there some other way than suffering to the degree that we now know he suffered? I find that to be a very, very fascinating thought. And if that was the intent, then of course the answer to that question was no. There was no other way. He was fully committed to the Father's will, and that's exactly what he had to experience on the cross. Thoughts that you have? Questions you'd like to ask?
So the cup was the suffering and not the act? I always thought that it was, let this cup pass from me, the whole act of dying on the cross.
Okay.
It's not that.
Well, would that be different than suffering?
I guess not.
Okay. I would look at those two in the very same way.
Oh, okay.
But I think I would add that extra point that when we talk about the cup, we're not just talking about suffering. Remember, when it comes to crucifixion, had anybody been crucified before Jesus?
Yes.
Sure. Anybody been verbally abused before Jesus? Sure. Anybody been beaten before Jesus? Sure. Anybody before Jesus been verbally abused and beaten and crucified? Sure. So what was the big deal for him? Well, but even with that, I mean, other people had gone through it. And they didn't have the experience here. I think that's why, one of the reasons why, when you see that word cup, there was something special about his suffering. And it was not just the verbal abuse, it was not just the physical abuse, it was not just the dying on the cross. But it was the full, unmitigated wrath of God. Nothing was being held back. He was going to get both barrels. Not one thing was going to be held back. Because he loved us.